Welcome to the 12th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Paul Rorschach-Tobia. With me tonight is co-founder Jesse Gitzman-Burke.
Hey, guys.
And rounding out the regular crew is Lester Crowe and his strolling bones.
Hello.
And Dan, Codan the Barbarian, Carrick.
Hello.
So, we're back with a full crew this time. Our 12th episode here, which means we've been doing this for pretty close to half a year now, that we've been rolling out these podcasts.
Don't you guys feel that Codan needs, like, whenever you call his name, he needs, like, I was going to say it. Like, he needs to beat his chest and, like, make out some war call, but that's, like, that's not quite the right one.
No, I was going to do, from the dawn of time, he scoured the distant lands. Kind of work myself up to that.
I've often wondered, Dan, do you look like the guy from Game of Thrones? Because isn't he the guy who plays Conan?
No. Wait, the new one? Are you talking
about? Yeah, Khal Drogo. Khal Drogo is Conan.
Khal Drogo? Oh, I didn't know that. No, yeah, I haven't.
I'm pretty sure it's him.
Yeah, well, hopefully I don't end up like him, because, spoiler alert, he died. So.
Yeah, but he's like a
hey.
Big...
Don't spoil that book that's been out for 12 years now.
Yeah, I know, right? I know, jeez. But you know people these days, they don't read books anymore. They depend on HBO to provide moments of entertainment.
Yeah, that was one of the fortunate books where I happened to read that book, the one book I read this decade, and short, like, minutes after I finished it, they announced that they were making the miniseries. It was like, dude, how cool is that?
Well, season one's over, so looking forward to season two.
It makes me think of Warhammer every time I watch it, so.
I know.
Cool. Speaking of Warhammer, we'll talk about that for a bit. There's really no news out there today. I mean, we were kind of trying to troll the internets and things like that, but there seems to be a little quiet. Maybe it's summertime. Maybe it's, people are getting off of school and things like that, but we're still here.
Fantasy Flight's pulled off of their 2 week, announcements for the time being, and maybe pushed it back to maybe every 3 weeks or even once a month until they get closer to a product release.
Yep. Yeah.
I was just going to say, it seems to me like they might be gearing up for like Gen Con announcements. Cause last year when they announced a whole bunch of stuff like back to back.
They did their whole sifting through the shadows document at that conference, didn't they?
Yeah, and then they had the video interview with the lead developer and everything, and maybe that's what they're doing right now is they're preparing for that.
Do you guys think we're going to get something similar to that this year?
I would hope so. A year out
kind of upcoming product?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
It'd be a good thing for Fantasy Flight to end the year on a good note.
When is Gen Con? Is that September?
No, it's in August, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, it's August.
Cool.
All right, so since there really isn't much news, we're just going to jump right into it. For our system spotlight, we're talking about time and how time is measured or kind of not measured in Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. And then for our main topic, we're going to go into how to be a good player, some of our tips and tricks on how to be a player in a role-playing game, just general usage, as well as anything specific for Warhammer 3rd. So
that's kind of going to be geared a little bit towards novice players, but also some things to stop beardy old vets from being unpleasant people to play with. So hopefully it'll be a little bit of something for everybody.
And also, we've got a handful of questions at the end of the podcast, but we're just going to jump right into it, not going to take a break, and just go straight into the system spotlight. So we're going to talk about time in the system spotlight, and one of the interesting things about Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition is how fluid time is. There really isn't any hard and fast measurements of what time is, and I think that confuses people and it worries them a little bit. But really, when you look at it, time is not necessarily important in the Warhammer old world, let alone within the game. When you're in encounter mode, when things matter, when the order of things matter, then you do have what the smaller instances of time that occur. You've got your turns and your rounds that occur. So everybody, you know, one round, you roll for initiative, whoever goes first or whoever's decided to go first in that initiative, they have their turn, then the next turn, then the next turn. Once everybody's had their turn, that's a round. And unlike things like, most other role-playing games, they don't specifically define how long a round is or how long a turn is. It's not 6 seconds or 60 seconds or something like that. It's variable. It's whatever it can be and whatever it needs to be.
And that seems to kind of translate or trickle down into the rest of the mechanics that the game system uses, which is that it approaches everything from a little bit of a high level. It doesn't get into the nitty gritty, like you said, if this is 6 seconds or 15. You know, if a turn needs to be 10 minutes because it's a chase scene, you know, every turn may have a variable amount of time, while if you're in a sword fight, each turn might be, you know, if you had to actually apply a number to it, might be much, much shorter.
And that's really the important thing is, you know, it slices up time to understand what happens next, to put things into order. But it's not the type of game where you keep a stopwatch. It's not the type of game where, well, you know, it only takes 3 seconds to swing a sword, so I should be able to swing my sword 10 times per turn, right? That's not the level of detail that they go down to. It's similar to the way that placement is handled in Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay as well. So we talked previously about the ranges and location cards and things like that. You know, it's what's close range? Well, close range is close enough to very quickly get into engaged range. What's engaged range? It's being able to touch somebody. Well, how long is a turn? Well, a turn is how long it takes you to do, how long it takes everybody to get something done.
Right. Absolutely.
So that's pretty basic. I mean, it's understandable and translatable across multiple role-playing games. When you're in that encounter mode, it's rounds, it's turns, it's initiative, it's who goes first, who goes second. But once you get out of that, or even within encounter mode, the larger time scales that they use start to get a little confusing, and I think some of it's the terminology, but I can't think of better ways, better titles to give it. But we're really looking at acts and episodes.
So in what way, Paul, do you think that people really get confused? I mean, I understand where you're coming from, but what would be some places that would cause a hiccup for some players?
I think it is we've heard a lot of questions, not so much of what is an act or what is an episode, where people seem, for me, to get confused is how do I properly implement it?
Well, and more specifically, the rally steps. The rally steps, because there's a specific mechanical impact to your game that occurs during this rally step, and it's often misunderstood, and I think we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that. But to set that up, you kind of need to understand what an episode and an act is. And really, in my mind, the way that I think of it is I translate it to television
or a website. Or, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's what's an episode. An episode is a 30-minute, you know, action. There's a small story to it, and then that action is broken down, or that scene, or that environment, that what happens.
What happens in that one room or at the coffee shop or what happened at the store.
Yeah,
your act.
So you're saying, like, breaking things up, is that what you're saying, or?
Well, the idea is an episode is a story within a story, right? So an episode, primarily, when you're in encounter mode, encounters happen with an episode. So take, for example, Day Late and a Dollar Short. Right? So people should be pretty familiar with that. It's the pack in that you get with either the GM's guide or the full set, the box set.
Yeah, the box set.
Well, no, that's
No, I'm sorry. No, the Daylight Chilling Shore was the free demo adventure.
Yeah, the free demo.
Available as a PDF on the support page.
Yeah. So the whole engagement with the gores, with the beastmen, that's an episode, right? That fight from when you first see them and you engage with them until you basically finish them off. That's an episode. And the episodes are broken down traditionally into three acts. And that goes back to kind of the play idea or even the movie or the TV idea.
That's Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. Where your three acts are, there's the setup, there's the conflict, and then there's the resolution. So there's kind of an arc to it. So again, going back to that gore attack right? The setup is that first engagement, right? That first round of Ungors that come out of there. And then the full conflict is when they call in the reinforcements and the Wargor comes out of the tree line, and that's when everything is up and running. And then after you take him out, then it goes back down to how do you deal with the guy and the coach? How do you, you know, kind of the resolution of how those things fall out.
But where do you see most players? I mean, I'm honestly trying to really gauge an understanding of this, but where do you see most players getting hung up on this?
Well, it's actually less on players, and it's actually probably more on the GM to understand and facilitate the acts and episodes in constructing their stories, because the players really just get to ride the adventure.
Well, they get
adventure.
To go on the journey, correct. Right. But so are you saying that people, because I mean, I'm trying to differentiate this, or are we stating that people who are coming from a different system, you know, more likely, I'm not sure how D&D, I mean, again, like I said, I've never played D&D. I'm not sure about the flow mechanics, but are we saying that there is a considerable difference between certain RPGs that really differentiates itself within the rounds that can sometimes hiccup a GM when they're trying to go through, you know, an adventure? Is that what we're...
I think it gets back to the rally step because the rally step, so the idea of having acts and episodes and things like that that roll up into an adventure and adventures roll into a campaign, there's nothing that prevents you from doing that in any role-playing game ever in the history of role-playing games, right? That's mm-hmm. just a way to tell stories. And once you think about writing role-playing games and things like that, you go back and you look at movies and you look at TV episodes and you say, okay, here's the third act. This is where things change. You know, this is even the episodes within the TV series and the acts within those episodes. But what's different with Warhammer 3rd Edition is again, it goes back to the rally step. Because when you switch between acts, they mechanically put in a specific break for that. It's like with a TV show, a 30-minute TV show, you've got your two commercial, or more than two usually, mm-hmm. you've got your commercial breaks. Rally steps are the commercial breaks. Rally steps are when the scene changes or when a new thing comes into being. It's the opportunity for it's a break in the action, an opportunity to kind of regather yourself. And the most important thing I think about the rally step is that it's the opportunity for the break for the players, not just the PCs. This is where you go refill the snack bowl. This is where you go have a bio break, things like that. It's mm-hmm. the ability to check your phone, you know,
so,
stuff
so
like
I have
that.
I have a question. Do you feel, I mean, being that I've never been a GM, you know, looking through, I mean, Jesse, you've GM'd some games. Do you feel that Fantasy Flight in their creation of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, that when they give you an adventure, do they allow you certain ways?
Yeah, they suggest opportunity. Yeah, they lay out all their adventures using this acts, episodes, and overall overarching adventure layout. And they also suggest when to apply rally steps throughout those. I find rally steps to be a little easier to relate to video games, actually. Any single-player video game has rally steps built into it all the time. So you figure, you know, you have a big, big blast of action, and then they give you a quick lull right before the next one where you get to refill your health meter, refill your ammo, or whatever it is. Those are kind of like rally steps. You have that break right after you fight a bunch of dudes, right before you fight the boss. You have that lull right beforehand where you can prepare and fight. Right before something new is introduced, or right after something big ends, that's when the rally steps kick in.
It's a really good tool for game masters, too. With all the different little components, it gives them a chance to prepare the upcoming encounter, or whatever is going to happen, too. So it's beneficial to both game masters and players, and I really like to use rally steps. That's one thing in our first game that we played, Jesse, that I noticed you were having a hard time kind of interpreting it because we weren't really implementing them.
Yeah, and I didn't understand them, so I just didn't even use
it. I had the same sort of problem the first couple of games I ran too, because that doesn't exist in games like D&D. It's just kind of the onus of the game master to
hey everybody, let's take a break
for that. Yeah, exactly. Whereas it's actually built into the mechanics of this game.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. And I think what I've discovered, learning more about it, is that don't get hung up on using it properly. Just go ahead and do it. Just say, okay, everybody, hey, here's a proper spot. Let's do a quick rally step. Everybody gains the benefits of the rally step. Everybody takes a quick 5-minute break, and then you move on. Just feel free and use them casually. Don't get hung up on the fact that if you don't use them right, something wrong is going to happen, or your players are going to get too many benefits. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, I mean, I can see where some people might not want to be the GM that slows everything down, but, you know, for most people, they enjoy that lull break that allows them to kind of regain themselves. I guess that's kind of what we're trying to say.
Well, the players should appreciate the benefits that come along with the rally step, because more often than not, it benefits the players by removing some stress. It removes some recharge tokens from their actions, drops them closer to their neutral stance, which is not, that's the only non-benefit, but does give them an opportunity to do a first aid check, if I remember correctly.
So what you get to do, so everybody across the board, they move one step in stance towards neutral. They remove a recharge token from every recharging card, which sometimes is good and sometimes bad. I mean, there's ongoing effects that you want to continue to have, happen, but it's basically a free round. Free round. Everybody recovers one stress and one fatigue, and you adjust power and favor like it was the end of a turn. So it's basically a free turn. A free turn where you don't do combat. And then you have the opportunity to choose an action. So all that stuff happens for free. So stance, recharge, stress, fatigue, and power and favor all happens for free. But then you get the choice to do one rally action. And then, so the rally action is either a maneuver, a first aid check, a resilience check to recover fatigue, a discipline check to recover stress, reroll initiative for the lowest person who got initiative, or perform an action with the rally trait. So those are all things that you get to do, one of those things, basically.
So your players really need to understand what they're capable of doing during the rally step, and the GM needs to be, it's kind of his onus to actually instigate them and kind of guide people on what to do.
Yep.
So let's go into episodes, sessions, adventures, campaigns. Those are each of the, they kind of have this three within three thing going. You know, there's typically three acts in an episode. You typically have, you know, three episodes in a session. You might have three sessions in an overall adventure, maybe three or more adventures in an overall campaign. That kind of three and three and three seems to, it kind of be a nice loose rule that you can use.
Yeah, I think it's more in my mind, episodes flow more into adventures, right? So each one is made up of parts of the whole, right? So
I'm sorry, I did say sessions. Yeah. Sessions is a sit down and play for the evening, however far you get thing.
Right, because there are specific game mechanics that are based on the session, right? So
yes.
There's a lot of capabilities that you have that are once per session. The Reichlander's ability. Talents give you that ability as well. You know, once per session you can do this. So that's an important timekeeping to keep, but hopefully you get through more than one episode per session, but really.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. I'm glad you mentioned it. I was going to ask, what do you guys typically cover in a game? I mean, I tend to, aim to cover one episode per session. Which means that, generally speaking, it'll be about a three-game session per adventure.
I think it so sessions, in my mind, are based on time. So being who I am, you know, pushing 40, got a kid, got a family, when I set aside time to do RPGs, I'm going to have a set time. It's going to be, you know, from 4 to 7 on a Tuesday night, or from, you know, 3 to 6 on a Friday afternoon. So it's really whatever I can just kind of pack into that time is what I do. Now, it's always nice to try and end your session on a cliffhanger, you know, have them always want to have come back for more. So, you know, ending on a rally step or ending after an episode, but setting up the next episode, those are good natural breakpoints, for your session, but mine are primarily time limited, not specifically, all right, I'm going to try and get through this much in this time. Cause I don't necessarily want to railroad the players into, okay, we only got a half an hour left. We got to get through this, this, and this.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. It's wherever the players end up taking the story is, that tends to be how my sessions run. So we could go, it could just turn into, you know, a drinking contest because that's what the players feel like doing. And we do that for an hour and a half and then, you know, travel for an hour and a half and then it's game over for the night. But,
you know, that actually might be a nice transition into the main topic because, I actually would disagree with Lester. I know some role-playing groups really like doing the allow the players to do whatever they want. But at the same time, I feel that the GM has a responsibility to keep the story on track, but maybe don't railroad the players into it, but at the same time, make sure that, you're not just running off into Never Never Land, spending 4 hours of our valuable time. Kind of like Paul said, you only have so much gaming time if you have kids and family and things like that. So I find it very frustrating when the story doesn't make progress.
Oh, I totally sympathize with you and agree with you on that point. It's just I have such a limited resource of players that I really have to walk on a bed of nails to keep them happy so that they'll play with me. Exactly. So I mean, I would prefer that we would go through the stories that I've prepared and written, but I mean, I'm facilitating, you know, a game night for them essentially. And if they want to waste their time rolling dice doing drinking games, then I mean, I can't really do anything about that. If I want to keep them as players though, right? I mean, I need to cater to them. But once again, we can talk about how to be a good player in the main topic.
Yeah, that's a really important point, Lester. You think about it, when you're the GM, you run the world, right? You're omnipotent, you're omniscient, you do everything that you can do. You've got all the power in the game world. But really, you're there in service of the players. You're there to have the players have a good time. So even though you control the universe, you're still at the whim of making sure that your players have a good time, or else your gaming group's going to fall apart and you're not going to game anymore.
You can only have a comet hit the earth and kill all the players so many times before they're just like, this is crap and I don't want to play anymore.
Oh, that takes me back. It's blue bolting. That was back, oh hell, 20, 30 years ago when I was playing D&D for the first time, and that was the bolt from the blue. You take damage equal to the amount of dice that are on the table. Jeez. The GM would just pick up all the dice and roll it and say, you take 400 damage.
Gosh. Is that what they called riding the blue bolt back in your day?
Yeah, that was blue bolting a player. So, interesting.
That's called you annoyed the GM and he wants
something. Yeah.
So the other thing that I want to point out, so drawing up adventures, you know, creating those sorts of things, there's plenty of good adventures out there and some not so good ones that are out there for Warhammer 3rd edition. If you can get a hold of some 2nd and 1st edition stuff, there's good adventures in there as well. There's campaigns that are out there, Gathering Storm, stuff like that. You know, if you're an old hand at making up your own adventures and campaigns, you know, we could do a whole session on how you tie together those episodes into an adventure, how you can tie adventures together into campaigns and how you can run things from one end to the other. You can do some really awesome stuff with that. One of my favorite webcomics, Order of the Stick, runs like a guy's campaign. I mean, you can see the player characters behind this webcomic and how it just grows into this huge world-spanning type thing. And there's a lot of opportunity to do that. But the one thing that I did want to touch on is the concepts of episodes. There's a lot of good stuff in things like the GM's Guide and the GM's Toolkit that gives you examples of what episodes can be. And it kind of breaks it down and gives you a couple of ideas on what the acts are, complications, the ability, you know, when's good for a rally step, those sorts of things. So that's some good stuff as a GM for you to have in your back pocket, especially when things start going off the rails. So, you know, oh, time to throw in a chase scene. You know, those sorts of things.
Doesn't the guy over at Daily Empire, wasn't he running like a competition for single, like one-off episodes?
Yeah, the one-offs. I read a few of those. Some of them were actually very good.
Are they one-sheet adventures? Or
yeah, they're one-sheets. Yeah, they have the three acts setup, in a all-on-one page, and it's meant to be kind of a single game session, one-off game. And some of them were quite fun. They were very fast-paced. They got you in the action quickly, had some fun, and got you out.
One-shots.
Yeah, yeah. I read one in particular which dealt with cannibalism, which was sounded like a blast. I'd love to run that one sometime.
Yeah, so but again, so they're not quite one sheets, but if you go into like the GM's toolkit, you've got things like the chase, meeting with a reluctant leader, you're not getting it, hold the line, the trial, ghost story, hostage negotiation, ambush, mistaken identity, you know, so there's a lot of good little, the cursed item, the rescue, you know, there's a lot of con game, delicate negotiations, the delivery, you know, there's a lot of interesting little scenes in here that are above and beyond just, you know, beastmen jump out of the woods, roll mm-hmm. for initiative kind of idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The only other thing that I'd say, and this is more of a personal thing, the idea of story beats, the idea that you don't have high action all the time, and that kind of fits in with the rally step, especially what you talked about, Jesse, in terms of taking a break. But you're not at high energy the entire time. You break it up. So you have a combat, but then you follow up combat with social or travel. But then you follow up the social or travel with another combat or another encounter. It could be a social combat, as well. So keeping that moving back and forth so that you're not spending the entire game session just doing the investigative part of things, but you're also not spending the entire game session in combat, you know, under initiative. I think having a balance like that is good to keep your players interested and to keep them engaged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, moments of combat are definitely not as exciting if that's all that ever happens. I actually quickly became unenamored with the idea of dungeon crawls quite quick in my role-playing career because, I mean, fighting's fun, but it only goes so far, in my opinion.
But conversely, if your players are stuck in a drinking game for an hour and a half, orcs kick down the door. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just can't go wrong with orcs kick down the door. Mm-hmm. Roll for initiative.
Sometimes you just gotta stir the pot.
Yeah, the bartender turns out to be a Skaven, and he eats your babies.
You look out the window and see a guy on fire running down the street.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so I think we've talked enough about time. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about how to be a good player.
Don't you mean we'll take a rally step?
Yes, we'll take a rally step.
Take that rally step.
And we're back. So our main topic tonight is kind of more geared towards new folks. That's where we got the idea of on how to be a good player. But it can also be for hoary veterans. What did you call it, Jesse?
Beardy veterans was what we always called them in the tabletop world.
Yeah.
Those are guys who've been playing forever and just sort of like rules lawyery, and
they got the sweat stains to really show they've been working, huh?
Yeah, those grumpy old dudes who compare versions.
Well, you got a problem here with your writing.
So I think the important thing is, and we kind of touched on it in the last segment, is that, you know, there is an interaction, right? Role playing is a group thing. You can't do tabletop role playing or online role playing solo.
You can't?
There are group dynamics that happen in there. It's not just the idea of you having a good time, but it's contributing to the group and the group as a whole having a good time. I think that's the number one thing, in my mind for being a good player is be cognizant of the group.
Kind of to Lester's point where if the group is having a blast drinking in the bar, as much as I might be gritting my teeth, it's an enjoyable part of the game for everybody else and something you foster to a degree before you have the Burning Man run down the street.
Yeah, well, you have to understand, everybody's there to have a good time. Don't be the one person that drags the whole party down, you know? I mean, RPGing is about everybody getting together, having fun, you know, and really enjoying this adventure, you know, and you don't want to be that one person trying to speed everything up just because you want to go kill things, you know?
Well, but so. I think kind of back to my point, and I guess maybe this is just my personal play style, is I feel that everybody does have an obligation on some level to contribute to the story and progress the story. You can't just linger in one spot and continually just roleplay it until somebody magically stumbles across button one that triggers whatever event the GM requires to keep the story going. At some point, the GM or a player or somebody needs to help push the story, and it's both the player and the GM's responsibility to keep it moving.
Yeah. And I think that that's also why you have different characters in RPGs, is because all of our different personalities can entail different characters, and that kind of, you know, helps with that in some ways to kind of get things going. You know, we all pick different characters. Nobody ever has the same character. So.
Yeah, variety is certainly key. I think that was actually one of our bullet points here we wanted to talk about, was that being a unique character or a unique player is far more memorable and allows for far better story interaction, both from the other PCs and the GM to feed off of. So, you know, don't be just the average fighter that everybody's seen. Be something unique. And I think Warhammer really lends itself with its career system to encourage players to be something unique and different that almost force some role-playing elements and stories into the character.
Yeah, it allows you to focus on a character as opposed to what their class is, right? Because mm-hmm. there's hundreds of careers. You can be all of the careers pretty much, but you want to focus on your character, not on his specific place in the world or her specific place in the world.
Yeah. And it's so easy to be unique or memorable. Just think about, you know, when you're talking about a coworker, you know, somebody who's an acquaintance of you. Oh, that's the guy who whistles through his nose all the time. Oh, that's the guy who always wears, you know, short sleeves and a tie. You know, what is that one affectation? What is that one memorable thing? You know, you carry around a lucky gold piece that you flip all the time. Maybe not a full Two-Face type thing, but you know, what's that one thing where if people say, oh yeah, that guy, are they going to say, oh yeah, that fighter? Or are they going to say, oh yeah, that guy that's always polishing his armor? Or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a good point. I like that. I also think another important thing for players to always be cognizant of is you lean on the GM to provide the hardcore rules or the degree of rules that everybody's going to be kind of adhering to. If you recall some rule in the book that somebody's forgetting or bypassing or something like that, really don't allow yourself to get hung up on the rules and rules lawyer the game. Allow the game to really dictate what is required, because, you know, maybe the GM is purposefully bypassing a rule to really, because he wants to narrate it out instead. Or, you know, maybe something to that effect.
Yeah, no, I agree, because, you know, I did a game where there was this one guy that, you know, as a, you know, I was very new to, you know, this game, and the guy kept fighting the GM with the rules. Oh, no, it's got to be like this. No, you're doing it wrong. And the GM basically was like, look, dude, it's my game. This is the way I'm running it. You know, some people like to pick fights. They want it just like the rule book, but you have to understand some GMs tone their games for their specific players. Or for that specific adventure.
Yeah, and it's written right into the rules that the rules are malleable and that the game master, at his discretion, can change them. It says it right in the book, so.
An example that comes right to mind for me is like a player who thinks maybe they deserved a resilience check for something that the GM didn't allot for. And you'd be like, hey, I want my resilience check for that. Don't I get that? While that seems really reasonable, at times it can become very excessive to always look for that one benefit that your player maybe or maybe shouldn't have gotten. And the GM, you know, when it's appropriate, he'll give it to you. But at the same time also, GMs do appreciate, because there's so much going on at any given time. If they've overlooked something that was very obvious, you know, they do appreciate having somebody say, hey, should I get a saving throw for that? Don't act like you're entitled to it, though.
Yeah, don't bark at a person and say, oh, no, I get this. No.
Yeah.
I mean, bring it up as a, hey, you know, I'm just questioning, should I be able to do this check? Oh, you know, yeah, go ahead. You know, so, I mean, all GMs sometimes make mistakes. I mean, come on, they're running a full game. Their minds are doing 30 different things.
Like, didn't I run three of our sessions without even doing the defense value of creatures in combat?
Yes. but that's well, is that, you know, the GM, granted that, I mean, you have to understand, these guys are creating the adventure. They're trying to remember 50 different things, and it's kind of hard for one small thing. You know what? They slip up. Hey, bring it up to them. Just be like, hey, I have a question. You know, should I be doing this check? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
You know what a great time to bring those questions up is?
A rally step.
A rally step.
Yeah.
Good call.
But I also think that as a player, to be like really nitpicky about things is bad, where you're like, well, because I told you he was always being observant, I should just automatically succeed on my observation check, or I should get, you know, 6 white dice because of this. I have one player who, for the most part, is a good player, but he's always fishing for those extra benefits. And I mean, yeah. The game's already slightly geared towards the players succeeding anyway, statistically speaking. So it just, that can become kind of bothersome when you get players who are like that, where they are constantly trying to fish for that extra blue dice or, you know, that extra benefit that's going to save their character or make their character look like, you know, this superhero or whatever.
You know, one big piece of advice I have for all players and GMs at the same time is, allow bad things to happen to your character. And I mean that in really every sense of it. Allow yourself to fail at attacks, allow yourself to fall flat on your face, allow some of your roles to just fail. Because what happens, I'm not saying fail all the time, but don't be disappointed when you fail at something, because some of the best storytelling elements come about when somebody fails to do something. Because that's when the really creative outcomes start coming up from the GMs and the players on the results.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Jesse, you remember our first game that you ran with me,
mm-hmm.
right? Remember, I created this whole character in my mind. It was like, oh, I'm going to win this thing. I go in, and what happens? I get stuck.
Yes.
And you remember you tell us the warp closed, and we got
stuck.
Yeah,
well, you threw yourself into a warp gate and had your soul shredded for millennia.
But for me, I was like, all right, well, cool. I'm ready to do another one. Let's go create another character, you know? Because, you know what? It's all about having fun, and that's what people need to understand with RPGs. Sometimes people, they have that win factor in their minds.
But
they want
to
win.
You obviously, but the fun part, I think, is that you, because bad things happen to your character, you didn't fight it. You're like, no, screw it. Oh, my guy lost his leg. I'm done. You know, so many cool role-playing elements come about from the bad things that happen to you, not the successes.
Exactly.
You remember stuff far, far more than you do the successes.
Well, there was the one guy that I remember, he became the giant and he grew and then he had a tentacle for an arm.
Yeah.
You know? I mean,
like, yeah, one of our players' legs grew like an extra 8 inches, like his bones just like stretched. He got a mutation and it was like, he's like, oh my god, I'm never going to be able to go into a city again. What am I going to do? You know,
that was cool. Then the gambler, but you
know. We gave him the nickname Lester, I think.
I think he was
from Canada.
I think he was, but you know, that was the thing. I mean, that people shouldn't get discouraged when bad things happen to their characters, because you know what? That's the evolution of play. It brings new elements to the game. It brings more life to the game. And it's not always about winning. Yes, some people would love to win combats, but you know what? It's taking those steps and evolving your character and going through the adventure to like, wow, okay, now I know it kind of played out like that. Hey, let's see what the next adventure, let's see what's going to happen to my character in the next adventure, if they live or die. But then it's like, hey, cool, my elf died. Hey, I want to play someone else. You know, they create a whole new character. And that's the cool thing about it. And that's why people should not be discouraged, you know, when their characters die, if they fail in an attack and they get stomped to the ground. You know, it's all that thing about having fun, building your characters, evolving from the gaming adventure. It's like, okay, well, hey, I'm not, you know, I'm going to learn from Jesse. I'm going to be a little bit more, you know, wiser and listen more to his details and not just jump into this perilous warp.
Well, yeah,
you know,
I mean, like, you're given that was your first game,
I
think that you were very, and I'm going to use that as an example where often new players are far more aggressive in what they
aggressive.
Do than maybe what some of the other players in the game were a little more conservative, and all of a sudden Dan would just rush right into a combat, or a new room, he'd run out in the middle and start running around seeing what to do instead of cautiously approaching a situation. And I think that what was really fun though is as he started receiving the detriments of his actions, he started to learn and adjust his character and how he acted in situations. And he had to get hit a few times in the head before his character could kind of understand why what he was doing wasn't really working.
Well, I did have before we started the game, so I was a little bit more anxious, as you knew I was antsy in the seat. But yes, it did. It evolved. Because, I mean, for me, as I said, you know, going back way back to episode 2 when I first jumped on the podcast, I was very new, and I was unaware of how fun RPGs were. You know, I was not
as knowledgeable as I am now, you know, now that I've got a couple games of Warhammer Fantasy, doing Death Watch, you know, and Dark Heresy, so I've gained more under my belt, which has made me a little bit more cautious and aware, and but also that aspect that it's like, hey, I'm here to have fun. And, you know, when I have players that are there to just win and they want, it kind of takes the game away from me. Because it's like, okay, wow, all right, dude, go ahead, go for it. Yeah, you really want to go search that pile, go for it. You know, it kind of demeans the game. And that's not what RPGs are about. It's about getting a group of friends together, having fun, you know, and
I think you can kind of sum it up as a, you know, roll with it.
Exactly.
Whatever happens to you, let it happen. But, you know, I think another one of our favorite quotes on here is, our good old Will Wheaton quote, don't be a dick.
Exactly.
Well, and I think that, I think that's a great quote for all around, but, you know, it's your attitude towards the game, the understanding that RPGs aren't about winning. They're about telling a story, and the more you recognize that, the better off you're going to be. I also think that you have to be cognizant of the people around you, right? So it's not just your interaction with the GM, but it's your interaction with the party, right? When you play the computer games, you're always just interacting with the computer, right? You put the inputs into the computer, it spits out the results. The GM takes place of that computer, but you've got those other people in the party as well that are interactive too. So the ability for you to work with them and say, instead of charging into the room, you say, hey, let's charge into the room.
Exactly.
You know, that's a whole different idea of how you're approaching all of that. And the understanding that if you are in a story, if you have the GM, and the GM, especially if you're in a campaign or something like that, the GM is going to set the limelight on characters, especially as your adventures go along and things like that. And certain episodes or certain parts of the adventure or certain adventures are going to focus on a person. Especially if you have like a lot of good backstory and history and stuff like that, GMs eat that stuff
up. Yeah, there's a good reason to have a good backstory is because you'll get a lot more attention.
I'm sorry, but you know, that was the thing, because when I first started, remember Jesse, you were like, all right, create your character's name, kind of give us a background. I was kind of like, what?
Well, most new players have a hard time with a background. I don't get it. What do I do?
Yeah,
and it may be the GM's responsibility to help kind of feed some ideas for them to help, you know, at least lay a groundwork for it.
And you did, because then I added stuff, you know, I had a scroll. I still remember to this day. It's like I had the mission from, the elders that I was sent to, you know, investigate the situation with this young boy. And so it was kind of cool because it then helped me. I was like, oh wow, you know, all right, cool. I can add this. And, you know, it kind of expands the story, I think, which was really kind of cool. Yeah.
The secret to players having a good background is that you're making the GM's job easier.
Mm-hmm.
You're helping the GM write the story. Your nemesis in your background is an easy nemesis to throw into the next episode.
Mm.
You know, so by doing those things, you're doing it for the GM. You're making the GM's job easier, and they're just going to pick those things out, those things that they already know that you're interested in, and make them part of the story and make them part of the game.
You know, one thing I'd like to add there is that most often new players will generate a history for themselves and they'll hand it to the GM. The GM will read it and they go on from there. But where I really feel something gets left out is the players talking about their history to the other players. Because more often than not, Paul, you have no idea what Dan's character is outside of when you started and you're in and went on your adventure. I really encourage players to talk to the other players about their history or reference things that had happened to them in the past. Because one, it'll help build conversation and dialogue between all the players, but it also gives the GM content to feed off of.
Mm-hmm.
So here's another note that we've got here. First person versus third person. What are your guys' thoughts on that? Lester, when you're a player or a GM, do you encourage first person versus third person?
Well, when I was younger, I used to try to do the first person thing a lot more. And then I kind of fell out of role playing for a while. I like the first person interaction. I think it helps to create immersion within the group. However, I find it hard, and I find a lot of players, especially new players, have a very difficult time with the whole first person thing. They get all nervous and stuff. So I'd suggest a fair balance between the two, I think, is the best way to go about doing it. I personally prefer to play my characters as third person. Although, I mean, if I was better at the first person interaction, I would, I'd give more of a shot at that.
You know, one thing I found is that it's certainly a comfort thing, and more often than not, I encourage new players to do third person. But I find that I personally prefer third person as well. But if I'm in a group that's very energetic and it's very free flowing, I very easily transition into first person, if the group energy is there. Mm-hmm. And, it's kind of like, if everyone's doing it, I'll do it too. If not everybody's doing it, then I usually default back to the safe third person.
It's the performance aspect of RPGs, right? Yeah. That's when you're completely sticking yourself out there and it's you're pushing forward your skill and your ability to be on stage, to be an actor in that case, as opposed to controlling, you know, your character, you're becoming the character, which is very scary. And, you know, if you don't have a background in performance or things like that, you know, you've got no frame of reference for it. But again, like you said, Jesse, if you can get a group that can do that, then it can be a cool thing.
And don't feel like you always have to talk in a funny accent.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
No.
That's the easiest downfall for everybody, because they always default to that, and then they run out of steam after about half a sentence, and then
because you're one person, right, and your voice is unique. Now the GM, unfortunately, has to be 20 or 30 people, depending on, you know, how socially interactive your adventure is. So, you know, when your barkeep sounds the same as the bad guy, sounds the same as the chaos sorcerer, sounds the same as the beastman, sounds the same as the skaven, that kind of takes you out of it. Mm-hmm. So silly voices are potentially part and parcel for what the GM
and more memorable too.
Jerry, I remember your silly voice that you used for that little snake guy. I still remember it to this day. Do you remember?
I don't. I'm not sure I want to hear it.
I'm not going to reenact it. I can't do it as well as you, man. But you look like you went back to your 12-year-old boy days.
I might have. Oh, yeah. I do remember it now. I do remember now. Yeah, we won't do that.
Yeah, I do have to say that as far as the first person and third person is concerned, it does, like Jesse said, comes down to group dynamics. If you have a group that's comfortable playing in first person, then that can be some of the most memorable role playing you'll ever experience. But once again, the comfort zone, a lot of people are not comfortable playing their characters in first person.
And there's really nothing wrong with it. I mean, it totally works in third person too, and actually allows you to do it more like you're reading a book or a story. Mm-hmm. You know, it allows people who don't have that acting ability to be equally as creative just through descriptive words.
Yeah.
Good.
Cool.
All right. So I think we'll take a break, and then we'll come back with your questions.
As always, you can submit your questions to recklessdice@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @recklessdice. Joseph asks, how important do you think it is to know and understand the setting and story of the world we play in?
Very.
Do you really?
I do really think that it is important. But once again, the beautiful thing about Warhammer is it is based in reality, just with some fantastical elements tacked on. So it's actually quite easy to find information out about Warhammer. Plus, it's the longest running role-playing world in the world.
I think it's the longest running consistently sold franchise.
Yes. So it's actually quite easy to find information out about it. And even if that's just a basic understanding of the geography or a basic understanding of something, some portion of the world, I think it is highly important if you want to create a more involved experience.
Yeah. And I think too, I mean, Jesse, you and I both come back from, you know, we
been Games Workshop since, you know, got the early 90s. So, you know, I think for us, since we had an understanding of the world, I think that it kind of enabled a better understanding, you know, of the story. I mean, that's why we know a lot about Skaven. That's, for us, it kind of...
Well, sure it does, but I guess the question, I think the key part is it necessary to enjoy the game?
I kind of do, because you know what, and I have to agree with Lester, I kind of feel that knowing the story or the history of, you know, Skaven, okay, if I went up against Skaven, I would kind of, since I would have a knowledge of them, I would kind of know what the tendencies of what the GM might use those Skaven and how he might use them. Or when it comes to chaos, I know all the chaos gods. So if I'm going up against a berserker, I know how to handle that situation, a Khorne berserker, or, you know.
Can I derail us for a quick second here and bring us back to a good player? Because Dan just made me think of something that I think is important to mention.
Sure.
Is, there's something that a lot of players don't innately know when starting off with role playing, and I'm not sure the general term for it, but I call it player knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I mean your character's knowledge, not so much player. So Dan knows all four chaos gods. Dan knows what Skaven are and what lizardmen are and the twin-tailed comet and all that cool stuff. But his character is his character's a rat catcher, an outdorf, who's, you know, really only had a crappy life in the brass tier for ages. That person's never encountered a chaos god and probably never even seen a chaos symbol. It just has the rumors of it. And you want to do your best to play your character knowing only what your character would logically know from that point. And that can be a very difficult thing for a lot of new players to not allow all their other knowledge to trickle in and influence their decisions.
Mm-hmm. But you Correct. Still need a little bit of an understanding of the setting and the story in order to, I mean, even if you are the rat catcher from Altdorf who knows nothing about the chaos powers, he still needs to know a little bit about Altdorf or a bit about being a rat catcher. So I think that it is important.
Paul, what's your thought on that one? Cause I have my own and it's so far very contradictory what you guys are saying.
I think it goes back to the question asking, you know, to play the game. If you're a GM, you need to understand the world that you've created, because the more background and the more information that you have about the world, the more you're going to be able to think on your feet and react to, react to your players going off the script.
Yeah.
I think if you're a player, I think you can come into it cold. I mean, there's stuff built into the player's guide. You know, that's the quick overview of the Empire, you know, chapter 10 of the player's guide, of the original player's guide. That's all that I handed my wife when we sat down and played Warhammer. She'd never played Warhammer. She'd never played, you know, the tabletop game. She'd never read a book or anything
but
like that.
But she read chapter 10, because then that gives her an understanding of the setting and the story.
She read chapter 10 in between like our first and second session. And again, it's to understand enough to be able to play your character. You don't need to know the world to be able to play the character. And there's actually a lot of joy of discovery, of learning sorts of things.
How cool could you have it be when your character, who's only been on their farm all their life, will discover their first creature in the woods or their first trickle of chaos and not even really know what to do with it? You know, when your character discovers Warpstone, but doesn't know what Warpstone is and accidentally just keeps it in their pocket or their pouch for the next month and all of a sudden develops a mutation and can't quite figure out why they got one. I mean, that kind of stuff is actually a lot of fun to teach your players about the world through the story.
Yeah, I don't think they have to know everything about the story, but I think understanding the setting, like if they think that it is set in ancient China or whatever, that's their preconception, then they're not going to be able to understand
everything. With the basic understanding that, my opinion with a basic understanding that it is a fantasy world, and you're in roughly medieval settings, that is enough for a player to join in on and enjoy the rule system. Mm-hmm. And then they can explore and learn from there. I totally agree with Paul, though, that the GM should have a pretty solid background in the Warhammer world before attempting to run it. Or, the game system lends itself very nicely to doing a generic, non-Warhammer-specific fantasy game. I mean, you can run a Warhammer game that doesn't deal with chaos and beastmen. I mean, you can have something that is literally just a chase scene with all within a town that deals with humans and normal stuff that could still be a Warhammer game. So you can always default to that if you're really feeling uncomfortable with the universe at the start. But I would encourage it because it's a fantastic universe.
Yeah, as much as I like the system, I'd rather play Warhammer. I'd rather play Warhammer, you know, I'd rather play Warhammer 2nd Edition than play, you know, Dungeons and Dragons with the Warhammer mechanics, Warhammer 3rd Edition mechanics.
Right, no, it's the universe that we come here to play.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to move on to our next question here. Elric Edge tweets, how do you feel about using action cards and party sheets for monsters? I found using Savage Strike for Beastmen put damage on the party pretty quickly. That was one of my concerns. I didn't feel that characters were getting damaged easily enough, and I've recently been convinced to utilize the action cards that I was told to, and I'm having a little more fun with it. How important is the action cards and the party sheets for the monsters to you guys?
I like them. I like to use them. Yeah, absolutely.
I do too.
Mm-hmm. It's easy to use. The party sheets do fun things like handle morale for you or the WAF if you're talking about green skins or, you know, those sorts of stuff. So it's that extra quirk because, your normal creatures, and this is kind of what we talked about last episode, your normal creatures don't get any talents. The party sheets for the creatures do have talent slots on them.
Can I ask a quick question for you, Paul?
Yeah.
When you use them, the monster sheets, do you use them in every encounter that involves those creatures? Or, so like, you know, quick beastman attack, do you pull out the beastman party card, or do you only do it for like larger scale encounters of that creature type?
It kind of depends. I mean, if there's enough of a group, because the Beastman card specifically has the morale, is one of the aspects of the Beastman card. So it's an easy way to track morale for the Beastman by throwing it out there. So even if it is just, you know, a band of Ungor led by a Gore, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It's not hard to do. It doesn't require a lot of setup. You know, you drop down the card, you throw a talent or two on it if you feel like it, and a token on there, and you're good to go. You know, just like everything else, all the rules are right there on the card, so it's. I wouldn't necessarily. I do it 100% of the time, but
the action cards for sure. You use those as much as possible.
Well, absolutely, the basic action cards, and again, it goes into the preparation of the encounter, right? So if the encounter is prepped, I'm going to have a set of action cards that are going to be set up for the guys to use. Whether they're the ones that come with it by default or something that I add to it myself. You know, it really does, if you just take the creatures as they exist and you don't use things like the ace dice, you don't use things like creature actions, they're going to get rolled.
Mm-hmm.
You really need, and it's boring. Melee strike, range strike, melee strike.
That's kind of where I was going with it, and then that's why after our last episode or two, I started pulling in those action cards again a lot more, and I started having a little more fun with it. So I was getting frustrated because characters were never taking critical wounds, and I couldn't quite get there, and the action cards were helping me there.
Yeah, I always, well, you know that I guess it's really hard to roll enough boons to get a critical hit, but
technically the creatures don't do that. The boons.
Oh, really?
The boons don't generate critical hits from creatures because they don't wield a weapon.
Oh, well, I always give them a weapon.
Right,
though.
That was my old alternative too, but I think where the criticals are kind of supposed to come from is through the action cards, because many of the creature action cards do distribute criticals.
I love using a perform a stunt on my creatures all the time.
And again, it's not hard to do, and the rules are built to make it easy. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have one action card for a group of creatures, right, if the Gore uses Savage Strike, no other Gores can use Savage Strike until Savage Strike recharges. That's written into the rules.
Right.
So you're not tracking
really?
A set of action cards. Yeah. So you're not tracking a set of action cards or recharge per monster.
Per monster group.
I always thought it was like if there was, say, you know how we were talking about henchmen last episode. So if I always thought if there were three groups of henchmen, each group of henchmen could use its Savage Strike once. But it's every beastman.
I don't know. Paul, what was your interpretation of that? Because I understood it like Lester just said it, but I could see it going either way.
My interpretation, and it may be wrong, and maybe it's just because I'm lazy and I don't want to have to track it. You know, you've got one Savage Strike, and that's being used. So
here's maybe an interpretation. Convert it over to players. there's only one action card of each type for the most part in your deck available for your players to take. So if one guy has sideways upside down strike, then nobody else can have sideways upside down strike. So it may actually translate the same way into creatures, where there's the one action card for the group, and that one can only be used by the GM as a whole until it recharges. Until, in the meantime, though, he can use his other action cards.
Okay, because I've just been using the different colored tracking tokens to track each group of henchmen, or if there's like a, say there's like a Black Orc war boss or whatever, he gets to use his cards, and then also all my henchmen can use cards. It's been good at dealing damage to my character.
I suppose there's no reason why you really couldn't do that, but I think I would, if I had to cast my vote, I'd say it'd be a little more in line with what Paul was describing.
So the one thing that, and your war boss should have different cards from the goblins, or the orcs, right? He should have his own particular action card that's specific.
But all three of them may have Reckless Cleave.
Yeah.
Right? In addition to that, your Black Orc might have two other ones that the goblins don't have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, you know, I may be wrong with that interpretation. I'm kind of shuffling through the books trying to find it, but it just makes sense to me. I mean, you keep the ace pools a little bit separate. That's okay. But why track? Why force yourself to do extra tracking, when you don't have to?
Yeah, good call. Well, that brings us to, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I might streamline my combats a little more. I found they've been not necessarily bogging down, but they have been taking a little longer than I had anticipated the game mechanics to allow for.
Well, that brings us to the end of the Q&A for this episode. And feel free and send us your questions. We'll read them off on next episode.
Yeah,
and I think that'll wrap it up for the episode as a whole as well. So we'll be back in 2 weeks with the next episode. Please drop us a comment, recklessdice.rorschach.net. Send us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @recklessdice, and we've got our Facebook page out there. We're going to do some more, get some more content and information out there as well, and keep you up to date on what we're doing with Reckless Dice. And remember, also give us a review on iTunes, good or bad, really. You know, I've said this before, but we love the feedback. Tell us what you like, tell us what you don't like, and we'll make the next episode better. So I think that does it. So thanks, everyone, and we'll catch you all next time.
Adios.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.
Elric Edge sent us a mid-air, blah, 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 blah. We're going to cut that section out?
I guess we are out of
it. I think we've got to keep it. Come on,
we're keeping it now.
We're keeping it now.
I'm editing the podcast.
Elric Edge tweets.